Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. The 2021 California legislative season brought the passage of many new bills, some directly affecting employers and employees throughout California. And yes, with a Democratic supermajority in the California legislature and a Democratic governor, 2021 brings another slew of employment law bills that expand many employee protections. Some laws may be as innocuous as providing information that employers are required to post at the workplace and allowing that they can also be provided to employees by email without relieving them, of course, of their obligation to post. Others seek to address rights when an employee is exposed to COVID-19. Tonight on Your Legal Rights, we're talking about new labor and employment laws passed in 2021. There's much, much to discuss. Our phone number right here is 415-841-4134. And again, to call us right here in the studio, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any questions on tonight's topic, tonight being labor and employment law. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. And please bear in mind that our attorney guest can't provide you with precise legal advice, as we won't have all of the facts relating to a given case. But we're happy to pass along the legal principles to assist your decision-making. And their guidance mightn't be the positions of their employees or their clients, but they're here to help. Our phone number right here is 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Joining us tonight, a partner in the firm of Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rudd, and Romo. Tom Lenz handles all aspects of labor and employment law issues and heads the firm's traditional labor and National Labor Relations Board practices. He works with employers in all major industries across California and the West. And Tom teaches at my alma mater, that's the Gould USC School of Law. Also joining us tonight, the principal at Mizrahi Law, Ramit Mizrahi, is recognized as a top employment lawyer. She's been selected to the Super Lawyers Top 50 Women in Southern California, appears in U.S. News and World Report's 2022 edition of the Best Lawyers in America for her work in employment law, representing individuals, and is a Pasadena Magazine top attorney. And last but not least, both of my guests tonight are past chairs of the Labor and Employment section of the California Lawyers Association. And with that, Ramit, Tom, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Jeff.
You know, I always like to start a show like this one and really see what's new in the news, what's bubbling up. Of all the stuff we've talked about before the show, seems like the big story tonight might be about confidentiality or silence, or silent no more, as the bill was called. Would you like to take a stab at this, Ramit, and tell us a little bit about what all this means?
Sure, I'd love to. So the Silence No More Act, SB 331, I agree with you. I think it's the most important bill from this legislative session. And what SB 331 does is it expands protections that were created in 2018 in the aftermath of the Me Too movement. So after the Me Too movement, we realized that the Harvey Weinsteins of the world could sexually harass people, pay them off, demand confidentiality, and do this over and over, and nobody would be the wiser for it because they had all signed confidentiality agreements.
And if I could jump in for a second, these are people that, as a condition of receiving anything, had to cut a deal and sign that they wouldn't tell anybody about it.
That's correct. And so in 2018, really focusing on sexual harassment and sexual discrimination, a law called the Stand Together Against Non-Disclosures Act was passed that prohibited employers from requiring confidentiality or non-disclosure agreements from employees who had either filed a sex harassment or discrimination or sex retaliation lawsuit or had filed a claim with the government. The Silence No More Act expands it, right, in the wake of the racial justice movement to cover not just sex discrimination and sex harassment, but all of the protected categories covered by our Fair Employment and Housing Act. So race, religion, disability, age, veteran status, it's a pretty long list. So that's one thing that it does. And that change kicks in on January 1st, 2022, that expansion. And another thing that it does is it expands a different law passed in 2018 that targeted some employers that as a condition of employment or continued employment or to get a raise or a bonus would require people to either sign away their legal rights under our Fair Employment and Housing Act, our anti-discrimination law in employment, or would make them sign non-disclosure agreements. And so it has also been broadened to provide additional protections to ensure that employers can't require any kind of non-disparagement agreements that have the purpose or effect of silencing employees, prohibiting them from disclosing information about illegal acts in the workplace. It also prohibits them from including in separation agreements, non-disparagement, non-disclosure agreements. And this is limited to situations where there isn't a lawsuit filed, where there isn't a government claim or an internal an internal complaint filed. So in a sense, what it does is it gives employees control. They can still agree to non-disclosure agreements if they have a negotiated settlement, generally with the help of counsel. But if they want to make sure that they can speak freely, they can file a complaint with the government or with a government agency or file a lawsuit.
Tom, I would think there'd be a time when you might have previously advised your employer clients that if you cross certain boundaries, you're going to have to pay. Has that changed to where now, not only if you cross these boundaries, do you have to pay, but it's pretty likely that the world's going to know?
I think it is pretty likely that the world's going to know, Jeff. I think that these are such high profile issues and people want to know what's going on. Employees are going to talk about them, whether employers like it or not. And I think this legislation is, really a wake up call for employers to, get a thicker skin. People are going to say things and you need to, really move on. I think that, trying to chill employee speech is something that California law is not going to accept going forward. And frankly, it's my view that federal law has prohibited this already for a while. The National Labor Relations Act has allowed employees to talk about wages, hours, and working conditions and prevented retaliation on this. But, this is going to raise the stakes. And as the law adapts to the circumstances that we're living in, I think that this is going to just bolster employees' protection. So employers are going to be well advised to pay close attention to this now. Maybe consider adopting these standards now in the agreements that they prepare, so that they're compliant going into 2022.
As we were discussing this now, something occurred to me that I candidly didn't think of when we were speaking before going on air. And that's the obvious question about whether these laws are reciprocal as applied. There was a time when I represented a government entity in dealing with some terminations. And one of the provisions to protect the employee was that the settlement was fully confidential. And it may have involved some of the same misconduct. Does the same inure to the benefit of the employer, being able to share the information about these employees and why they're no longer there? Or is it pretty much a one-way street?
I mean, so this is really targeted at the employees who are alleging that they were subjected to discrimination, harassment, retaliation, right? These sort of protected activities. There are protections built in for the employees. So the employee can ask that the employer not disclose information that identifies, that is identifying of them. The employer can also, you know, ask for confidentiality on the amount paid. It's just the facts of the wrongdoing that the employee is free to speak about, but can seek protection, you know, to protect their own identity.
So Tom has an employer, and Ramit, you represent an employee, and an employee goes forward and makes a complaint of mistreatment, whether it's discrimination or harassment, and you've reached an agreement where perhaps the employer wants confidentiality. Well, according to this, it's confidential no more. But Tom's employer does the next step and looks at the lower level management employee who is really the source of the problem that, Ramit, your employee was complaining about. And they say, we can't have people in management doing these kinds of things and do the right thing. Is the company able to disclose that? Is only the employee that originally complained protected? Where do these protections go?
So I would say generally that the identity of the person who complained should probably be protected. But there's nothing stopping an employer from taking corrective action against a harasser or a wrongdoer.
Absolutely. The law encourages employers to promptly address, investigate, remedy situations of, let's say, harassment in the workplace. And so I think an employer would be well advised to follow the policy that presumably it's trained its management team on and to address that right away. And most employers that I work with aren't going to want to, you know, say much publicly about these situations. They're trying to avoid a negative image. So this is something they'll want to, as best they can, keep under wraps.
Anything else that you would want to advise your employers or, Ramit, advise your employees about these protections before we move on to another topic?
I think that employers need to address this issue in the agreements that they use. If they're using a template that a lawyer might have provided them, if they're using some sort of legal Zoom or something to prepare agreements for the workplace, you need to make sure that you are updated in what you do. And frankly, that's one of my mantras about updating your policies, updating your agreements to comply with the constant developments in the law. And we see so many developments every year, and it's been just a fire hose of developments the last year and a half, 2 years, when you add the pandemic. So be current with what you use, because you don't want to be getting in trouble using something obsolete or trying to enforce it.
Yeah, and I think for employees, they just have to know that they have a choice. Right. It was thought that maybe an employer might be willing to pay more money for confidentiality in some cases. And there may be some cases where, for example, a high profile sex harassment case where that may still be true. I let my clients make an informed decision. Right. If you agree to confidentiality, it is forever. It is for the rest of your life. Or you can file with a government agency and take that off the table. No confidentiality, period, right? So I think, everyone's going to have their personal choices, and they get to make those choices now.
The next thing we talked about is getting a lot of attention out of Washington right now, because it's in the new bill on infrastructure or about some of the social changes, and then it gets taken out, and then it's in, and then it's out. And that, of course, is family leave. What's new on the California front with regard to family leave?
And I'm happy to jump in on that. So we had an assembly bill, AB 33, that made a few more changes to our California Family Rights Act. So you know, most people listening have probably heard of the FMLA, the Family and Medical Leave Act, which is a federal law. But my guess is that fewer people have heard of the California Family Rights Act, which is the state law that is comparable to it. It used to be that the FMLA and the California Family Rights Act, or CFRA, were virtually identical. They were different on some, you know, kind of minimal areas. But last year, the CFRA was expanded, so you don't need to have 50 or more employees in a 75-mile radius. It applies to employees who work for companies with five or more employees. There are some eligibility requirements. You have to have worked, for a year and 1,250 hours, but it now applies to many more California workers. So last year it was expanded to apply to more people by allowing, covering employers with five or more employees. And it also was expanded to allow you to take time off to provide care, not just to a spouse, a parent, a child, but also grandparents, grandchildren, siblings, domestic partners, adult children, and children of domestic partners. They inadvertently, even though they had planned to expand it to parents-in-law, in-laws, they had inadvertently left out parent-in-law from the definition of parent. So they fixed that this year. So it's worth talking about because a lot of people don't realize that if you do need to take time off to care for, a sick relative, family member, even for your own health conditions, that the CFRA is now much more expansive. And if you work for a small company, you may still be protected.
One of the things I noticed in this new provision, it appears that there are some guidelines for mediation.
That's right. So one of the compromises that was made in the legislature to provide these huge expansions of leave rights to California workers was creating a pilot program for small employers, right? The legislature was worried, can the mom and pop shops, survive this? Do they know what their legal obligations are? And so the compromise was that before a person can bring a CFRA claim, California Family Rights Act claim, against a small employer with 5 to 19 employees, the California Department of Fair Employment and Housing, the government agency that enforces these laws, has a mediation program that the employee and employer can participate in before the employee files a lawsuit in court, right? So the employer and the employee have to both want to opt into it. And that program is out there to see if those cases can be settled before having a lawsuit filed.
Is there anything unique about this from the employer perspective, Tom?
Well, I think that, the pilot program for mediation is important because I think if there are ways for small employers to resolve these issues outside of court on a more efficient, expedient basis, that's a good thing. And I think it helps people follow the law and maybe understand compliance. As far as the expansion, we expect California law to provide for more rights than under federal law. California always raises the bar. This is another example. I've heard people joke about, who really wants to take leave for something related to in-laws. But seriously, I think that it's important and people will take this leave. Leave of absence has been a critical matter, particularly during the pandemic. And I think that we've had a real need to ensure that people get the time they need to address not only their own circumstances, but their family, both immediate and extended. So it's a good thing. And I would add that employers need to look at their policies. This is a theme that I take very seriously because if you are going to live under the law, you should have policies that are legally compliant and then expect to live by those policies. And that means revising them every year or two as the laws change so that you're not enforcing rules that are out of date. So employers need to pay attention to that. And even the small employers covered by this law need to be prepared to provide that leave.
Yeah. Now, bear in mind that this leave is not paid for by the employer, although if the employee has certain accrued vacation or sick time, depending on the type of leave that's taken, that the employee may be able to use that time. But if a person is taking time off for their own serious medical condition, they might be able to get disability through the Employment Development Department, the EDD. They might also be able to get paid family leave for taking time off to care for a loved one. So there is wage replacement available depending on the leave and the amount of time that they need. Also know that in California, we also have a pregnancy disability leave law that covers people for conditions that are related to pregnancy or childbirth. And it could be everything from morning sickness to bed rest to, then they have their baby and then recovering, postpartum depression, et cetera. So in theory, a pregnant person could get up to 4 months of pregnancy disability leave and then another 12 weeks of California Family Rights Act time off for baby bonding. So it can be big, even for small employers now.
But the takeaway is talk to an attorney first, because your job may be protected, but your income maybe not.
Correct.
Yeah, the EDD has some pretty good resources too. So I would say, your employer has notice requirements that they have to comply with in terms of telling you what your leave rights are, how much time you're entitled to, et cetera. So look at those, make sure they make sense. And if they don't, then you have the ability to kind of seek counsel and hopefully navigate that and make sure your employer honors their legal obligations.
One of the other areas that struck me as rather interesting involves the military. Now, we know California wants to take the lead and maybe lead the federal government sometimes to follow us. But it did strike me as being unusual that we've developed policies for dealing with the military. In particular, I'm looking at changes to the law regarding military sexual harassment. Can you talk a little bit about where we get the ability to do that?
Sure. So Senate Bill 352 that deals with military sexual harassment is really focused on the California military, right? The California National Guard. And it amends our California military and veterans code to make sure that if a member of the active military serving on state duty sexually harasses someone, that they can be prosecuted, either in a military proceeding or a court-martial, in addition to potential civil prosecution. They can be held liable. They don't get to hide behind the shield that they were on official government duty. And it also creates some reporting requirements on the part of the California military on their website. So this is really yet another offshoot of the Me Too movement to try to shine a light on sexual harassment in one of the places where it is incredibly rampant, and protecting the service members themselves, right, who are subjected to sexual harassment, and making sure that they have recourse.
Of course, we can't reach people that are stationed in bases that are perhaps those of the armed forces of the United States. It's really limited to the National Guard.
It's the California military. So, yeah, but hopefully it will set a precedent that, maybe our federal government can look at.
Yeah, I expect that, the state law is going to try to reach as many different working environments as it can, in hopes not only of setting a rule, but also setting an example. And if something was to happen at a federal level that provided greater protection, as harassment issues all over the place are in the media and gaining attention, I expect that, employers all over need to be aware, whether it's public sector, private sector, and now in the state military, the National Guard.
And while we're on the topic of harassment or discrimination, it'd be remiss if I didn't bring up a very small niche area, but it looks like there's some new requirements for somebody to become a nurse in California or to remain one with regard to that. Would one of you care to comment on that? I see you're both nodding and ready to jump.
Well, AB 1407 was passed, speaking of implicit bias training for nurses. And implicit bias is something that, you know, we've talked about in previous shows, and it's certainly something that is an important part of, you know, the issues we're talking about today in terms of harassment and discrimination. And this law is going to require that nursing schools and programs include implicit bias training as a requirement for graduation. So with so much attention being focused on healthcare in the last couple of years and skill shortages all over the place, not to mention the harassment and discrimination issues that are out there, this is, I think, intended to, you know, help remedy those issues up front.
One of the areas, and it's not really strictly an employment issue, but one of the areas that this might hopefully address is that certain groups, whether it's women versus as opposed to men, whether it's African Americans as opposed to Caucasians, there are certain groups that face discrimination within the healthcare system that's completely unconscious and unconscious or implicit bias, and they're not getting the same medical care because their complaints of symptoms are discounted or looked at so differently that the evaluation of their condition is different, and they don't receive the same care, even by people who maybe intend to provide equal treatment. It's just not happening. Is that really what this is, more of an issue than an employment issue?
I think it may well be. And I think healthcare employers are concerned about the quality of care that they provide. And I think in some ways it is, you know, arguably helping them to achieve their mission. Although I would imagine that, you know, there's going to be, you know, some discussion as to, you know, how prevalent this is and, you know, what the nature of the training will be. But I think that implicit bias is a very hot topic, and it, someone may not intend something or at least believe that they are, you know, treating people differently. But in fact, that may be occurring. So it's bringing awareness to that, which is important.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights, of course, Senate Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. We have some very interesting programming coming up next week. Are people suffering from mental illness overrepresented amongst the homeless in the criminal justice system? We take a week look next week at mental illness and conservatorships and what we can do to throw a lifeline to people. In 2 weeks, we take a look at race and social justice. We discussed that a few weeks back with regard to employment. In 2 weeks, we're back to look at how those issues have impacted the criminal justice system. And then we're back on December 1st, looking at tax tips you can use. As 2021 comes to a close, what should you be doing to prepare? Best of all, we're here. We answer your questions live on the radio. That's Your Legal Rights, Wednesday night at 6 o'clock on KALW 91.7 FM or KALW.org. You're listening to Your Legal Rights, and we'll be back right after this.
Emily Ratajkowski is incredibly famous on Instagram as an actor, as a model, and her new book is about her relationship with fame and with her body and with control. She'll tell you what it's like to be defined by beauty and what happens when you lose control of your own image. It's coming up on Q from PRX.
Q from the CBC this evening at 7 o'clock right here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area and worldwide at KALW.org. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Law Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. For the details, you can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Jeff Hayden, and tonight we're discussing talking about new labor and employment laws that passed in 2021. Whether an employee or an employer, my guest, Tom Lenz, and Ramit Mizrahi, are here to help. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. Tonight we're talking about new employment and labor laws. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. I think we're going to spend most of the rest of the night talking about various changes that involve wage and hour. One of the first things that I noticed in our discussions before hit me close to home as I defend criminal cases and sometimes white collar cases, and this talks about wage theft. I always thought wage theft was theft and would be treated a lot the same, but apparently it hasn't been. What's changed with this law? What changes start in the first of the year?
So with the passage of Assembly Bill 1003, wage theft is now grand theft. There's a penal code that's been created, Section 487M, and it provides that an employer who intentionally deprives an employee of wages, including tips, amounting to more than $950 from a single employee or independent contractor, or $2,350 total from two or more employees or independent contractors within a 12-month period can be prosecuted for grand theft. And that can be treated either as a misdemeanor or a felony, right? Which means that it brings jail time. The wages, gratuities, benefits that are the subject of the prosecution, the employee can recover them as restitution. And it protects wage theft, or covers wage theft by both, from both employees or independent contractors. So basically it is making the penalties greater, right? Taking it to a potential felony and really making clear to employers that when you are holding back and not paying employees the wages that they're due, you're stealing from them. The same as someone, stealing someone else's car or stealing an item from their store or from their house.
One of the things that struck me in reading the text of this new law, it seems before that if I took a little, maybe $20 a week out of the paycheck of somebody, nobody's going to think of that as a big deal. They may say pay it back. But it looks like now they're going to look back over the course of a year and say, wait a minute, you took $1,000. That's grand theft.
Yeah, I mean, there were civil penalty options, right? And the labor commissioner is very strict about enforcing those, right? If an employee is deprived their overtime, their rest breaks, their wages that are due, their final pay, there is recourse. And there was a potential misdemeanor that could be brought up, but this is really making a very strong point that the California legislature will not tolerate wage theft from workers.
This is a really big change, and I have to believe that the employers I'm working with are going to be scared to death to be hit with a wage claim because of this change in law. Because, the ramifications are so much greater than they have been, and as Ramit stated, the wage laws are very strict. In California, they are designed to protect employees and to ensure that the hours they've worked and the wages that they've earned are timely and properly paid. So, what this really signals is that employers are going to need to be thinking about their pay practices. They're going to need to make sure that they are in compliance with the current and frequently changing rules and minimum wage rates and so forth that operate in their industry. And if they are faced with the type of litigation that we frequently see on wage and hour, query whether they need to think about retaining criminal counsel as well. Think about whether, you know, there could be arrests involved, Miranda rights. Think about whether there might be some privilege against self-incrimination that is in question, and whether they waive that by responding to discovery or an investigation on wage and hour and pay practices and so forth. It's going to really complicate things, which is great for lawyers, but it's not so great for the people who are involved. But at the bottom line of all this for employers is to comply. And I would just add to that, that this is a wage theft concept, which not only involves people regarded as employees, but it also regards independent contractors. And we've talked in previous shows about the gig economy and Uber, Lyft, people who are regarded as independent contractors, but who various courts or agencies may regard as employees who've been misclassified. So I'm expecting, and I'm telling my clients that, you know, if you consider somebody an independent contractor, you know, that's like waving a red flag at a plaintiff's lawyer. You better you know, check that out and be absolutely certain you know the risks, because it's high stakes.
And that's really the trend in California, is to move more and more people out of a classification as an independent contractor and make more of them employees.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a reason for that, right? Because when you're an employee, you have all these protections that you don't have as a contractor, right? You have protections against certain forms of discrimination, harassment, retaliation on the job. You have rights to these leave laws that we were talking about. You have rights to, you know, sick pay and sick leave, right? You have rights to disability insurance and unemployment insurance and things like that. So it makes a huge difference for workers. And as I think a state, the legislature, you know, the state of California, the legislature really wants to make sure that workers are not being deprived of these rights that they should have.
We've been talking about wages, salaries. What about tips?
So that counts, right? It's part of that wage theft law. But there is a really interesting assembly bill, AB 286, that applies to food delivery platforms. So basically, the pandemic decimated the restaurant industry, right? And that's an industry that has always operated on really razor-thin margins. But people now, a lot of them are doing takeout, and they're doing it through these food delivery platforms, right? The DoorDashes and the Uber Eats that charge really hefty commissions and pretty opaque fees. And so AB 286 is meant to protect both the restaurant workers and the restaurants themselves. It makes it unlawful for a food delivery platform to retain any part of a tip or gratuity. So if there is a gratuity and there's a delivery driver, the delivery driver gets to keep it. If there's pickup at the restaurant gets to keep it. It also prohibits these platforms for charging a customer more than the price that is listed on their website at the time of the order. And it requires that they give both the customer and the restaurant or food facility an itemized cost breakdown of each transaction. So there's clarity, and there's also making sure, right, if you're tipping someone $10, you want to know that they're getting the $10. You don't want to find out that actually the platform's keeping some huge chunk of that. And so this puts more money in the pockets of workers and in the restaurant's pockets as well.
Was that an issue before, where the platform would take not only a chunk of what they paid the restaurant, but a chunk of the tip you left?
Yeah, that I mean, I think a part of it is you didn't know where, right? Was it a service fee? Was it a tip? How much went to the worker? And so that was a need that was being addressed, making sure that every dollar that you thought you were giving to your delivery driver to the restaurant is actually going to them.
Yeah, this is good. It'll provide some more transparency. And because California law is so strict on wage and hour and making sure people are properly paid, this will hopefully add some clarity.
What about people who don't get paid wages per se or hour per se? What about people that get paid for production? The first one that comes to mind are garment workers, for example, who have worked in sweatshops for hundreds of years. And they're often paid a pittance per piece. Has that changed in California?
It has. And so this year, and of course, this could have been a 3-hour show because there's so many new laws. But, you know, there were a lot of industry specific laws. And so one of them was targeting garment workers. So it's an industry that is really rife with exploitation. You have a lot of immigrant workers. Many don't speak English. They often get paid what's called piece rate, right? So by the unit or item that they produce. And the California legislature found that they're making an average of $5.15 an hour, right? Like nearly a third of the minimum wage. And a lot of them lost their jobs in the pandemic, and those that didn't were working in unsafe conditions. And so this bill bans piece rate compensation for workers, making sure that they get paid the minimum wage at least, right? And fining employers for every pay period that they do continue to pay employees by the piece rate in violation of the law. It also puts on the hook not just the official employer of the garment workers, but also contractors and what they call brand guarantors, jointly and severally liable for the full amount of unpaid wages and other compensation, making sure essentially that the workers have recourse against not just their official employer, but the bigger companies that are allowing this to happen to them.
This is going to create some interesting issues. I mean, there's been a trend over recent years of really spreading out potential liability among different employers who knew or should have known of potential abuses and failures to comply with the law. And this is really going to, I think, add some due diligence requirements, I think, for people to see who they're doing business with and how they're treating their workforce. If they're going to sell those products, because retailers could be on the hook if there's something made that does not comply with the wage and hour laws. And I'm expecting that you'll see defenses in court that, this is unfair. I had no notice. There's some sort of due process violation that, makes applicability of this law inappropriate, but still California law is going to push it, and they are going to see how far they can go in holding people responsible.
We did receive an interesting call from a caller who does not want to be heard on the air, but wanted to express a question related back to AB5. And of course, that talks about who's an independent contractor and who's an employee. And the question was how this person might be able to comply, or to what extent can he or she be excused from compliance when their own income is so irregular, so up and down, that they're not really sure how they can have somebody else working with them or working for them.
So I would say AB5 does not look at that, right? They have this very clear test, right? And essentially, if you have a person working for you in the same business that you're working in, that is one of the prongs of the test, and there's a presumption that they are your employee. Now, the thing about AB5 is that there was a lot of kind of sausage making in the creation of this legislation. Every industry was trying to lobby to get out from under it. And so there are a lot of carve outs and exemptions for specific industries, for specific types of business relationships, you know, business to business or, you know, referral services, but they're so technical and so complicated. So what I would say to every employer is first you have to figure out, does AB5 apply to me, to my industry, to the type of work that I'm doing, right? And sometimes that requires a lawyer because AB5 is so long that neither Tom nor I have it memorized, you know, and we're employment lawyers and this is what we do for a living. And if it applies to you, I mean, there's really not a lot of recourse. You just kind of have to navigate it and figure out, you know, how to proceed with your workers.
I would add that, yeah, AB5 was modified a little bit by a bill that passed the following year. There are some exemptions, such as business to business, that might be available, but I think how you transact with another party, the terms of that deal, will all be important to either see or adjust to make sure that you comply. And I think something that needs to be said about AB5, AB5 has the ABC test, a very powerful test, which more likely than not is going to reach the conclusion that someone is an employee. Even if you are exempt, you still have to look at independent contractor issues under the pre-existing standard, which is the Borrello standard. That's the name of a case that the California courts decided. And it's still possible to find that somebody is misclassified and not an independent contractor under Borrello. It's just a looser standard than the ABC test under that legislation we call AB5.
We spoke about per piece employment, such as in garments, but it seems that there's still certain quotas in place for other industries that one wouldn't think of as so arcane as garment making. The first thing that pops in my head is the people that work in warehouses and some of the things they've been subjected to. What is on the horizon for them?
So this is another, I would say, COVID-related bill, not explicitly, but with the right, with COVID, you had a lot more people doing online shopping because they're trying to avoid going into stores. And so you have, you know, you have online shopping, next day delivery, just-in-time logistics. You know, these distribution centers have become these real pressure cooker environments. And employees sometimes have these work quotas of certain, you know, things that they have to move, transactions, what have you. And, you know, when you have really intense quotas, you may not feel that you have the time to take a meal or a rest break, right? To eat your lunch, to go to the restroom, to wash your hands and, you know, get your PPE on. And so AB 701 was meant to address that. And it requires that in warehouse distribution centers, when they use quotas, the employer has to provide employees upon their hire or within 30 days with a written description of the quota, including the number of tasks or materials to be produced or handled, time, and the potential you know, negative consequences of not complying with that. It explicitly says that quotas that would be so intense that they interfere with a person taking a meal or rest break, using the bathroom, or following health or safety standards are prohibited. That an employer can't punish someone for meeting a quota that would interfere with their compliance with these laws, or punishing them for a quota that they didn't receive a copy of. So it's really just trying to protect these warehouse workers. It doesn't say what these quotas can't or can be, just that they can't be so bad that, for example, someone can't wash their hands or go to the bathroom or take a lunch break.
I think this is important. It's going to help employers and employees have a better understanding of what's required, and hopefully it'll help prevent some injuries in the workplace that have been, you know, coming up just because of the high pace of activity in these warehouses. Possibly it could help avoid some of the meal and rest period litigation, which is just epidemic in California. There are, of course, potential penalties and liabilities for employers who do not observe the requirements, not only on wage and hour, but in providing the meal and rest periods required by law.
There's another bill addressing quotas, this one in pharmacy chains, right? SB 362. So in passing the bill, the legislature made some findings that a lot of pharmacies have quotas. They're driven by profits and they lead to really high stress environments. And, you know, when you have a pharmacist who's rushing around too quickly, you're going to have dispensing errors and public health risks. And so this bill, SB, the bill adds a section to the Business and Professions Code that bans chain community pharmacies from establishing any quotas applicable to the duties of pharmacists or pharmacy technicians, and another section that allows the California State Board of Pharmacy to take enforcement action. So hopefully pharmacists are not pushed so hard that they're rushing around and not double checking, verifying, asking the right questions to make sure that people get the medications that they should actually be taking.
You know, that's critical, because in that particular industry, not only are you talking about exploiting workers, people that might not be able to take the time off they're entitled to, but the potential for public health for people who never worked in the industry and are completely outside of it to suddenly face dramatic consequences because they were given the wrong drug, or suddenly they run out a day early to something that's critical. It goes without saying. You know, in the last couple minutes that we have left, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about things that are more specific to COVID, such as displaced workers. Can we talk a little bit about that and what's new on that horizon?
Yeah, absolutely. SB 93 was passed, and that is a law which is really going to require employers to consider bringing back people who were reduced in force due to the pandemic. And until December 31, 2024, employers are prohibited from refusing to employ, terminate, reduce compensation, or take other adverse action against employees. And it's broad in terms of laid off employees, someone who is employed by the employer for at least 6 months before January 1, 2020, and whose separation was due to COVID. So there's protection to try to get people back to work. We hear a lot about employers not having enough staff, that there's a skill shortage and so forth, but there's a protection for employees as well. So this is important, and it's something that is there to protect the workforce, ensure that they've got a job to go back to. And I think that in these times, protection is needed. And that's above and beyond what might be, if you're in a unionized facility, in a collective bargaining agreement.
Yeah, and SB 93, Tom, that Tom was addressing, is really targeting industries that were decimated by COVID, right? So it covers hotels, airport service providers, and event centers, right? The very sorts of places whose business largely disappeared for a window of time and had probably the most massive layoffs. They also tend to be larger employers, right? It's not just your mom and pop store, right? It's these big chains, big hotels, big airport service providers who can have the resources to track who was let go, allow those people to have information about rehiring and bring them back on.
And that might apply to even people who got caught up in the structural change, like fewer people going to the office so they don't have as many janitors. Well, we're essentially out of time, and I did want to give each of you about a minute for any closing thoughts you had. Ramit, you're new to the show. Would you like to go first?
Sure. You know, so like I said, this was really a bumper year, right? I wish I had more time. My website, MizrahiLaw.com, has a blog post, and it covers some more laws that we didn't get to cover here tonight. But I think the real takeaway is that, you know, the California legislature in particular is incredibly protective of workers. Every year we add on new protections. It's incredibly exciting for me as someone who represents employees because we see a need. Legislation is drafted and generally it passes. But I think the big takeaway is there are incredible protections against, discrimination, harassment, retaliation. The wage and hour protections are getting stronger by the day. And I think that if a worker feels that they're not being treated fairly at work, that they should try to educate themselves, right? Research it, reach out to lawyers, try to figure out what your rights are.
And Tom, any closing thoughts?
Yes, I completely agree with what Ramit just said. And there are so many laws that it can be really a storm of information for employers just to get up to speed with, let alone to comply with. But that effort is going to be worthwhile because it's so much less costly to come into compliance than it is to go through litigation and fight over these issues. So it is a constant homework assignment to make sure your policies and your processes to deal with employees are legally up to date and compliant and that your management team is trained. And I would encourage you to look at the resources we have available on our website, not to mention our webinars, which we've been doing throughout the year and we'll use to touch on the new laws. That's at www.aalrr.com. Thank you.
No, it's our thanks to you. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in the San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight, we've been discussing new labor and employment laws that passed in 2021. Our guests tonight have been Thomas Lenz, courtesy of the firm of Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rudd, and Romo, and the principal at Mizrahi Law, Ramit Mizrahi. Thank you both. Tonight's show was produced by yours truly. Are people suffering from mental illness overrepresented amongst the homeless or in the criminal justice system? What can history teach us about how we might better provide treatment for these folks? What is wrong with the current system? What are we doing right? Please be sure to join Your Legal Rights again next week, Wednesday at 6 p.m., where we will discuss laws affecting the rights and treatment of those amongst us who are suffering from mental illnesses. Best of all, we will take your calls and answer your questions. A big thanks to tonight's guest, Tom Lenz and Ramit Mizrahi. And on behalf of Your Legal Rights, a big thanks to all of you for listening. And at the controls, D Minor. I'm Jeff Hayden. Be safe and have a good night.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Laura Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. You're listening to KALW San Francisco Bay Area.